Welcome to the Yokoji Zen Mountain Center podcast. Every month we share at least one new talk on the practice of Zen Buddhism at cmc.org/podcast. You can also find us on iTunes, Spotify, and all other podcast apps. If you find these talks to be valuable, please consider supporting Yokoji by donating at cmc.org/donate. We rely on your support to continue sharing this life-changing practice. Thank you. We hope you enjoy the talk.
Good morning. I hope you're all well. Today, I was asked to give a talk on the Obon Sagaki Halloween Day of the Dead ceremony. Whenever I think of ceremonies, I usually look at it from the outside. You know, like, you know, how is it viewed from the view of society? But again, that's just really my projection on ceremony. As a kid, I never really liked ceremony, and I didn't really understand it. In seeing human beings, though, I've seen that. We need something to sort of help gather our minds together to either face up to difficulties or to face up to rites of passage or to face up to our responsibilities that we have in this life. Ceremonies usually don't come from nowhere. I just remember recently I was reading somebody's views on ceremony, how they looked at it, and for me it really didn't show the spirit of ceremony. You know, if you look at the words, you know, obviously the English word ceremony, it comes from the Latin word ceremonium, to cure. Or if you look at the word ritual, it means to make right. How do you do that? As a human being, that's a very tricky thing. I don't know if I want to spend the entire period of time sort of going over the ceremony thing, but I wanted to read a koan, or at least part of a koan, which to me is what... ceremony is, and I bookmarked the wrong one. There we go. Here we go. Okay, attention. Emperor Shikuso asked National Teacher Chu, 100 years after you die, what would you wish? The National Teacher said, build me a seamless tomb or seamless monument. So you may wonder, you know, what is this seamless monument? Like for me, really, it is the heart. It's the heart of practice. You know, what is that? Really, it's the desire to really appreciate this life. You know, it may be starting off with how do I end suffering. It could be, how do I reveal the mysteries of this life? It could be, how do I help people to appreciate this life? Now, ceremony deals with this. 100 years on, in many ways, we'll maybe not remember the attainment of masters of this day. But we will remember the heart that tends to continue through the approaches to practice. Now, this Obon ceremony that we've done, it goes back to the Buddha's time, where apparently Maudilayana, the black magician who had to work off a lot of karma, His mother apparently had this vision of his mother hanging upside down in hell, which is not the greatest thing, I guess. Mm-hmm. You know, so he asked the Buddha about this, and the Buddha said, "Well, really practice very strongly, and we'll get everybody in this the training hall to practice very strongly too. And at the end, we'll dedicate all the merits to her." And so they do this and they practice very strongly. And at the end of the training period, then the Magdalena, with using his supernatural powers, goes back down to hell and finds that his mother is no longer hanging upside down in hell, but has been released. You know, maybe she's right way up now, but at least it worked in whatever way. So that's one. And that's also, you know, important in terms of, say, a daily practice, one that's maintained, is that that feeling for others is very important, the people that are around us, again, on a momentary basis. The second thing with that is, you know, many of us do have an idea of, you know, attainment and maintaining that attainment and then holding on to that attainment. One thing that this particular koan does is that, or this ceremony does, is that, you know, how does it feel to give that away, if it's possible to do that? You know, how does it really feel to give away whatever merit you have, like it doesn't mean anything? I mean, if you can, that's great. You know, also looking at that is that, what does it mean to give everything away? Does it feel any different? You know, for me, it really doesn't. You know, I can hold on to feeling, you know, this way, I've attained this, I've done all of these things, and I can list them and go into all that stuff. But it's a lot better not to have it even there. You know, just let it go. Let it be as it is. Receive the feedback from the world on a momentary basis without the filter of attainment is an amazing thing. So, you know, this ceremony traditionally was done in the summer, but because we moved our training periods around, because, you know, basically I got kind of tired of doing training periods over Christmas where people would commit to being there, and on the 19th of December they would go off and party for 2 weeks and come back or not. You know, that was always the thing. So it would leave the training just to a few people. So we put it in spring and fall, which traditionally doesn't fit, but in many ways it does for us, because we also have the aspect of Halloween. Now, Halloween for us in the West is a fun, you know, dressing up type of ceremony. Traditionally, that was where the veil of life and death grew thin. You can see that reflected in Day of the Dead, which is almost at the same time, where we begin to remember those things that are difficult for us. You know, the coming of winter, facing up to the fears of winter, maybe food shortages, maybe scary animals coming out that are haven't been fed, you know. Those kind of things. So we bring those up so that we can face them. And just in the same way is that in terms of practice, we raise up those things that, again, are difficult for us. The hungry ghost, that's the sagaki part. Now, the hungry ghost, you know, whenever we kind of look at those things, they're usually done like these are outside of who we are. But really, those hungry ghosts are who we are inside. We have all kinds of hungers for all kinds of things. And it's very important to look at those things. Do we feed those aspects in whatever way? Or do we really see how those aspects work in our lives? Do we really map them out and see how they function in terms of our own lives? In many ways, that's feeding them, seeing how they function, being able to bring them out onto the surface and actually deal with those aspects, see what the reward is, see what the cost is for each of those things that occur. So with this, you know, with this aspect of ceremony, you can begin to see that it's not necessarily the view of the ceremony from the outside. It's what that internal work really does. You know, are we feeding those hungry ghosts that want company? Are we feeling the hungry ghosts that want to have more than we really should have in many different ways? Are we feeding those hungry ghosts in ways of service, for instance? And that's where we get into another aspect of this multifaceted ceremony, which is the five Buddha families. So, you know, many of us have a view how practice is. Well, I think every single one of us has a view how practice is and what we value most. If I talk with people, you know, some people go, yeah, we've got to do lots and lots of Zazen. You know, so then you go into the Tathagata or the Buddha family. If you like study and you like wisdom, you like change, then you are not change, but you like that deepening of wisdom, then you're in the Vajra family. You know, some people really value that. And then there's the one of the study spheres. So if you really value that, you practice that, you talk about that, you talk with your friends, etc., about it. If you really value, say, work practice, then you talk about that, the giving in that respect. If you really value relationships, then you practice that. You practice in the Sangha. You do events and stuff like that, which really generate the enthusiasm that goes on in practice. Now, the important thing in these is they're all important. You know, every one of these houses are important, and I'm pretty sure that most of us are a combination of those families. In various ways, we value two or three of them, and we practice those. Maybe we look down on some of the others that practice in a different way. Or maybe we're really enthused by how other people practice in various ways in these families. But again, with this particular ceremony, it's reminding us of these aspects of practice. It's not just, you know, practice, gain enlightenment. You know, which some people, you know, just attest to, and then I'm done. No, there's relationships. You know, how do we deal with those relationships? Now, those relationships that we have on a daily basis, quite often are the ones that that change us, that transform us in dealing with people that maybe we have we don't have an awful lot in common with. Like, I remember going to ZCLA and then practicing with many people that were there when I first came to America. And then some of those relationships and how I saw people practice really changed me as a human being. And what also happened is that even people that I had no real affinity with, in practicing with them, they showed me parts of themselves and the ways that they practice that really sort of warmed my heart in many ways, and also showed me diligence in ways that I normally wouldn't have seen. Some people are very meticulous. Some people are very articulate and could express the Dharma in very wonderful ways, or even just express their feelings in various ways. I remember Gyoku Roshi and myself, we didn't have an awful lot in common. It's not that we disliked each other. No, I mean, we practiced together, and now whenever I call her, we may be on the phone for about an hour, you know, just catching up in those ways. Is that you change, you mature through interaction. You learn different ways of relating to people and interacting in those ways. You know, maybe you could say then, maybe you get put into membership where you have to deal with people in many different ways. Then again, you have to learn ways of interacting on many different levels. You may be put into situations where you're working with people, and then how do you use those bonding experiences to really develop, and then to take on the service of others through work as well. You know, so each of these these houses are important. And it's also similar with the study sphere too. Is that for us in the West, quite often we don't know an awful lot about Buddhism. I remember in the first few years, I read a lot about Buddhism and Zen and various, you know, schools of Buddhism, etc. It was really useful to learn, simply because in our own culture, we don't usually read an awful lot about Buddhism and how it's practiced, and we quite often again have an image of what that is, and then through reading, there was like little sparks almost that really helped in terms of learning about that, and then I remember a bit later talking with Sogen Roshi, who is a teacher in the, or a, you know, very high-ranked teacher in the Rinzai school, who runs Shogenji Monastery. And we were just talking about stuff. And he goes, and almost condescendingly, he said, "You know a lot about Buddhism, you know." And so I had to put it into context of that, not defense, because, I mean, I don't think there's anything wrong with that. It's just, you know, we're not a Buddhist country over here. So we need to know these things so we can relate to people in many different ways, just like in this ceremony, we have five different kinds of Buddhism right there, you know. But obviously it's important to be able to appreciate those five different kinds of Buddhism. It's not that we should fit into one box, just do this, and then look condescendingly down at somebody else and how they practice. No, rather see how their practice works, and then fill in the gaps for ourselves if there's something missing. You have to remember is that for us in the West, we've only received a few different kinds of Buddhism from the East. So if something seems to be missing, then it's important for us as practitioners in this country, in the West, to be able to fill in those gaps with whatever works for us in whatever way. So again, you know, these are the five kinds of Buddhism. The service sphere is also very important, I think, which is the karma family, is you know, being able to serve people in whatever way, you know, to integrate that within our society. And then interact in ways that really reach the people of this day and time. All right, so we've got that. So we look at again this koan where National Teacher Chu, who was a very great master. In fact, you know, the title itself, National Teacher, means a lot. You know, he was so highly regarded that he was teaching emperors, but what did he regard most importantly in this? Well, you could say, you know, he valued the Buddha sphere, or the sphere of what we would call meditation practice, wisdom. But there's something more here, you know, is the emperor who's concerned about legacy. It's like with any government, any ruler, they want that governance to last because hopefully it has been of benefit. The Chinese have a nice statement, which is, if the emperor is good, you don't notice he's there. I wish we had something similar, you know, in our own governance. I don't care who, you know, is president or whatever, but I wish we could notice they're not there, but it's kind of like rammed down our necks right now. But again, you know, in 100 years, what's your legacy? What's the legacy you want? You know, again, you have to remember that the Buddha wasn't, as far as we know, he wasn't into making sure that Buddhism continued, you know, his teachings continued. It's just that ending of suffering was the most important thing. National Teacher Chu says, you know, build me a seamless monument. And so what is that? You know, I mean, you can look at it physically, which is kind of funny, is that how do you make a seamless monument? You know, something like, an obelisk or something. It has to have a base quite often. How do you make it seamless? There's no cracks in it, you know. I think the Egyptians did a good job, but still, you know, there was ways that they had to put seams in there. And then there was, you know, there's things like Napoleon's tomb. You look at that. That's a good, you know, tomb, monument. It's got a lid. It's got whole, you know, it's got parts in it. It's like put together. It's an amazing piece of architecture, but there's still seams. And really, it's not until recently, you know, where we got concrete, we could pour things into one, you know, into one seamless edifice in that way. So what's he really talking about, you know, underneath is that, yeah, the national teacher dies. Then what happens? You know, and if we say 100 years, it's doubtful that one generation is going to last 100 years. Usually we say there's about four generations there, 100 years hence. He says, build me a seamless monument. So the monument of the national teacher is how do we really make that survive for future generations? You know, Maizumi Roshi was very concerned with that. You know, he said to me, you know, I hope this old cedar tree lasts for 300 years. And I know he wasn't talking about the cedar tree. He was talking about Mountain Center and the practice itself. There's something. But again, it's not the physical form of that. It's the spirit of practice. How does that continue? And that's something that is important. You know, in when Master Dogen was talking about practice, he said in the Buddha Dharma, we don't consider deep or shallow. What's most important is one's sincere practice. And that's something always to reflect on, you know. What is that sincerity? Only you can answer it for you. Only I can answer it for me. You know, am I being sincere or am I putting on the veneer? Am I putting seams into this? You know, where I look a certain way rather than what's the internal work that's going on. Again, as a teacher, it's a lot easier to deal with somebody who is sincere rather than somebody that's putting forth the veneer of practice and looking a certain way. You know, that sincerity really is if there's something there that I really need to deal with, then it is being dealt with. Not, well, I'm going to cover that up until it's exposed. You know, it's just like, how do I really deal with that? That's that seamlessness. So again, that's the national teacher's desire. It's also the Buddha's desire. This is implicit in this this Gate of Sweet Nectar ceremony that we did. Again, the Obon Halloween, Obon Sagaki ceremony that seems to fit with our own society. Is that this feeling that is there, you know, it's just like, how do we really bring this out to the surface? All these ceremonies are about that. You look at, say, daily service, what are they for? You know, I'm grateful to the Buddhas, that's the first service. Second one, I'm grateful for all the ancestors because they were like me and they did their best to bring it down to the present day. I really want my ancestors and friends that have passed away to be taken care of in one way, to, you know, to donate the merit to them in whatever way. And the fourth one's the prevention of calamity, whether that's possible or not. It's important to put out that feeling that I hope people don't have, get sick or things along those lines. It's important to have that feeling, that heart. You know, otherwise we tend to lose our connection with the rest of the world. So these things, if they're put forth on a daily basis and we have that aspect of curing, and again, the basic curing that we have as human beings is to move from our self-centeredness and have, you know, a feeling or an empathy for the rest of the world that we live in on a momentary basis, because that is born with us or as us, depending on how you really want to look at it. This world has always shown up 24/7. It doesn't matter. That's supporting me day by day. That's the thing that's feeding me on a momentary basis. You know, again, it's ceremony, it's recognizing that ritual to make right. And then whatever we do over the top of that to preserve that, yeah, that's a good thing. So, you know, build me a seamless tomb. These reminders too, over and over, we are the one who has appeared as thus since beginningless time, the Tathagata. That takes a bit of pressure off on some levels. You know, is that since beginningless time, it has been like this. It's not that, you know, we've attained this amazing thing and nobody else has done that beforehand, like a lot of New Age type groups do. No, it's an acknowledgement is right now I appear like this. You know, that seamless monument is like Maizumi Roshi taught when he died. Just his body wasn't here. The spirit was there. This whole world was here on a momentary basis, manifested as mountains, trees, sky, cities, cars. That world doesn't change. What did he transmit? He transmitted exactly that, but he didn't give it away. People realized it of their own accord. When that realization occurred, then there was no problem in terms of going, yeah, you've lived this way, you've realized this, you've been living this way, go on, bugger off, go and do what you need to do to pass on this for future generations. And that's so important. Again, you know, one of the questions that he asks, and this is one of the beauties of, say, the teaching of Maizumi Roshi, and, you know, I copy it in many ways, is... he said, what's the most important thing about Buddhism? And then people came up and said, you know, it's about getting enlightened, you know, being greatly accomplished. And there was like a whole litany of things, and he just sat there shaking his head. And it was kind of disturbing for a lot of people because... you know, they had a lot invested in enlightenment, and he goes, "No, it's ending suffering." So people, you know, kind of screwing their faces up and going, "Well, you know," but again, that suffering as a mechanism for change. Again, that's what this ceremony is about. It's a mechanism for change. Acknowledging all the things that we are as human beings, knowing that we have the power to make those changes if we really want to, by dealing with our own stuckness. You know, that's that aspect of the word suffering, apparently originally in Pali or whatever it was written in the first part, or spoken in, I should say, was this one here is a stuck axle wheel, and that's what the Buddha said on his enlightenment. This one here is a stuck axle wheel. Or, you know, it's taken as this is the fact of suffering. I mean, it's not we get rid of suffering. Suffering becomes a mechanism for change. There is the point of realization where you realize your, to use a highfalutin word, your universal nature. But in seeing that, suffering is part of that. And then how do we do that? Not only for ourselves, but the world around us. That's why, again, it's feeding these hungry spirits. Where do we end and where does the world begin? Again, you look at the Buddha's life, 6 years in training to come to this realization and 40 years of trying to convey this and trying to end suffering. And you could say, yeah, he failed, you know. But what a glorious failure. 40 years of doing the best that he possibly could. And again, this seamless monument is passing that on for future generations so that can be taken care of. You know, when the things that are difficult for us as human beings are raised up to the surface, then you can see them and they can be dealt with. They don't go off on automatic and then cause damage to other people around us. You know? And again, if they do, we have atonement. That's another ceremony. Yeah, I've made these mistakes. Okay, don't identify with that. But now, you know, I'll do the best that I possibly can to move on from this. And then personally, in society, I would rather have that than going, well, no, I didn't do it. It's not my fault. It's somebody else's fault, you know. But if we can take responsibility for that and own it, then we can do something about it. We can move society forward in a positive way rather than the image, the story that goes around it. But it's that inner work that constantly goes on for us as human beings. But that inner work also manifests on the outside. When somebody else is working really very intently on what they're doing, is it benefits me? Because I'm not the one that's receiving it in that way. And it's the same way is that we work on this, that is improved too. That's the beauty of, you know, ceremony again, going back. I hate the word ceremony because it's used now. It's like something you have to do to get beyond to something else rather than the process of curing. You could say Zazen is the deepest ceremony because you're doing the work right there. It's curing, you know? And again, that's the aspect that should go into Zazen too, is that not only am I making this clear, but also I'm making that clear. And that begins to occur. Not only clear, but I begin to appreciate the world a lot more than normally I would. Now, I've talked on this for about half an hour, which is the usual presentation time. So if you've got any questions or comments, please bring it up. And just realize this is a hard thing for me to talk about. But I took it on.
So you can now unmute yourself if you'd like to jump in, make a comment, or ask a question. You can also use the raise hand feature, and I've opened up chat. I think, yes.
Thank you, Tenshin.
Yeah, you're welcome.
Would you, I've been thinking as you talked about the role of ceremony in practice.
Yeah.
Could you talk a little more in more general about what you think about the importance of ceremony rather than, let's just say, our normal living our lives normally to the fullest and then doing something different that we call ceremony?
Yeah.
The difference between
I think in the West we don't acknowledge the value of changing forms. You know, I remember when Frank Zappa was playing in Australia, somebody was yelling at the police, going, you know, I won't say the expletives, but he was kind of like we're all free because we're wearing jeans and t-shirts, etc. And he goes, don't kid yourself, everybody in here is wearing a uniform. You know, as when we appear in the Zendo or the Buddha Hall or the Dharma Hall, we're wearing a uniform. That uniform means certain things. You go out on the street and people dress pretty similarly. You know, it's a uniform called fashion. And there's certain ceremonies around that. And we think we're free because we wear a certain uniform, a certain fashion, you know. We may go to see the investiture of a president or whatever, inauguration. There's a uniform that people wear. You know, you go on a date, you dress up, you know. And then there's certain results from doing that. If you don't, the results don't occur. It's a different form of ceremony. You know, we don't recognize ceremony that we put in there. A rock concert is a ceremony. You know, it's just we don't like to recognize those things as being so, and we put things into compartments, you know. It's like for me, as if, and I've not done this for a long time, is if I play a game of soccer, right? And it's an important game. It's not just a pickup game. There's a ceremony that I go through that helps me to gather my mind before it starts. And then all of the things that have been embodied appear in that game. It's a ceremony. You know, if I don't do the prep, the things that are negative then appear in the ceremony of that game. Now, when I do, and I'm pretty bad at this. I don't go to service much nowadays because I'm usually doing dog sun because I'm drinking coffee for the first, you know. But that aspect of ceremony, when I do it, it's a very inclusive thing. It's training. You know, for one, because I have to do certain things, my mind's a lot more connected and collected. And so then that it's a mindfulness training that then other people are involved with. You know, so there's choreography there. There's the musical aspects of the bells which coordinate with that. So it's an awareness. It raises that sense of awareness. But that's very important. But it's that feeling that's maybe more important of gratitude. I'm very grateful for the Buddhas. I can't do much for the Buddhas of the past, but I can chant to the best of my ability. I can give that feeling of gratitude, which is important. And the same for the ancestors, again, because they're like me. They were the beings that took that place and did it for a while, you know. And it's that heart that hopefully then service begins to bring into other parts of our lives. And the recognition of the importance of connections with people and the interactions with people. And more importantly...
Go ahead.
Yeah, I'm talking a lot. You carry on.
Okay. Yeah. Sorry. Didn't mean to interrupt, but there's this, you know, internet lag. You know, what you just said made me think of what Thomas Merton said about Thich Nhat Hanh, and he said, I could tell he was a real monk by the way he closed a door.
Yeah.
And you know, so do you think is there a way for our own practice that if we brought a consciousness that, well, hey, when I go, you know, to the grocery store, when I do whatever I'm doing, I'm going to try to make it a ceremony rather than just whatever.
Yeah.
You know?
And I mean, again, that's, you know, I mean, just look at our language is that, you know, you can see it's like, yeah, I'm just going to get my shit together, you know, rather than, hey, I'm alive. You know, what do I want to do? You know, and then bring that out. Which is, and that's more of a sense of ceremony. And for me, that's what ceremony has done, is doing that on a daily basis, is doing that. And just with that awareness practice of take on positions wherever you get the opportunity, and then those interactions and the timing and all of those things begin to appear, like in work practice. You know, for me, it's the work practice is, you know, and... It can be called either work or practice. You know, it doesn't need to be work practice. It's the same thing. But it's with that is if you do the prep and you do the things that are necessary for the work practice, then things flow. You know, it's like doing rehearsals with anything is things flow. Keeping yourself fluid with things makes things flow. And then in time, that's a very beautiful thing. It's, you know, like now with COVID, and what I call Groundhog Week, you know, is that it doesn't really matter what fills the space. As much as I love Hosan, I love it, you know, and sleeping in and everything, is that I know that is exactly what my life is at that point. And then flowing back into Zazen, doing interviews, doing all of the aspects of the temple day. That's exactly what my life is at that point. And it's not been attached to those things. You know, it's like with a song is that, you know, I might like the solo in a song or a part of the song, but the whole thing's important or else that solo would have no relevance. You know, so it's just like, how do I value this and this and this and this? And that's what ceremony does in time.
Yeah. But, so I think about like Orioki, you know, for like eating as a ceremony and then like tea ceremony. And you know, maybe there's brushing the teeth ceremony or using a toilet ceremony or, yeah, you know, yeah, I don't know, yeah, to the degree that we can.
Yeah.
Good. Yeah, I mean, it's the making special of the ordinary, huh?
I mean that's what an altar.
Having an attitude of making special.
Yeah, well, it's, you know, I think making special can be extra, but for me, it's more like I'm alive right now. How do I want to live? And I can spoil that in many ways, but I know what works for me as a human being. If I devalue this moment in time, then I'm more than likely going to devalue other moments in time.
Right.
And, you know, that's why we have the Buddha on the altar, is that he's in a high spot. So if you remember that aspect, that you are the Buddha in the sense of the awakened one, is that then that aspect of ceremony then is transferred into all the other aspects of your life. Not as something special, but, you know, the one who sees through these eyes hears through these ears. And then just the aspect of impermanence. Yeah, I'll be dead soon, so I might as well enjoy it.
And the idea that we would enjoy ceremony more than non-ceremony in any context, right? I mean, if we decide to ceremonize, all right, that's not a word. If we try to make a ceremony, you know, I'm going to make it this ceremony of backing my car out of the driveway,
yeah.
You know.
And it's
that will help me enjoy it more than if I'm not making it a ceremony.
Yeah. And, you know, part of it is that appreciation or being aware of the fact that that's what you're doing. Or even being lost in what you're doing, even better.
Great,
thank you. Appreciate it.
Thanks, Yurio. A bunch of hands up. Bruce, you're up next.
Bruce, I can just see your ceiling. I don't see you. And you're also...
Hello?
Hey, hi. Nice. You're unmuted. Good.
Well, thank you.
Oh, come on.
Good morning, everybody.
Oh, morning.
Well, it's 12 after 12. totally forgot what I was going to say. well, I was reflecting on, you know, Oban, what you were saying, and this seamless thing. I was driving one night. I had to go to the emergency room, and I drove down to Temecula.
Yeah.
And, you know, these phones are wonderful now, because I talked into Google. I said, where's the nearest emergency room, you know? Mm-hmm. And there you go, you know.
You have, yeah. Mm-hmm.
And I drove down there. It was midnight or whatever. Mm-hmm. And on the way back, it was later, and it was very foggy down there. And I was coming up the mountain. It was very foggy. And I thought to myself, wow, I wish I lived here. Instead of where my house is, because it's a little clear, because I like it with more moisture.
Yeah.
And then it just came to me very strongly. It's like, well, the earth doesn't really have any, you know, there's no divisions, you know, there's no boundaries, you know, there's the whole earth.
Mm-hmm.
And like a seam, you know, there's no seam really.
Yeah.
You know? It's in my head, it could be, you know. But anyway. That's what came to my head.
Thanks.
When you were talking.
Good. Well, I can't really say much on that. I agree with you. Thanks, Bruce. Yeah.
That's good.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Thanks, Bruce. Good. Lena?
So you have to unmute yourself. There you go.
Roshi, good to hear you. Today is the 49th day of my brother's passing.
Yeah.
And he was my only sibling and the only person left in my family aside from his two sons.
Mm-hmm.
And I've been doing the Daishi Nirani every day.
Yeah.
And it's been really a wonderful practice. It's been a wonderful experience because I wasn't close to my brother, or he wasn't close to me for most of my life.
Yeah.
And then just the last couple of years, he was, he valued our connection.
Yeah, yeah,
and
yeah.
I've been feeling like, very literal, maybe it's very childlike, I don't know, I don't care. I've been feeling like I've been walking with him through this and supporting him. And it's been very touching.
Yeah.
Very touching. And I'm grateful. I'm grateful. So now today's the last day.
Yeah.
What do I do now?
Yeah. Well, you know, the main thing is to carry on. That connection's there, whether you like it or not. It's just like the older you get, quite often those things are separate. As when we're younger, they tend to fall off on one side, and the love and connection for somebody else tends to come through. At least from my perspective, I could see that in Maizumi Roshi too, as well. You know. And so, you know, the important thing is that appreciation is really important. And you don't have...
I'm very...
Yeah, you don't have to finish that appreciation because it's 49 days. You know, those memories are good, but just let it be organic in your life, you know?
Anyway.
Yeah, thank you. It's good seeing you.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Good to see you.
Yeah.
Thanks, Lena.
Right.
Anya?
Morning, Roshi.
Morning.
Wanted to thank everybody.
Yeah.
Pardon?
Long time no see.
Long time no see, right? I was so grateful that we could be together yesterday. And share our hungry ghosts.
Yeah.
I want to say that, in my teaching, in my program in particular, and I think it's unique to our program, we start every day online or in person with something we borrowed actually from the Suzuki violin method.
Yeah.
And we say... we actually sing with solfege hand motions. We are ready to teach. And our students learn to sing back. We're ready to learn. And at the end of the class, we say, thank you for your learning. And they say, thank you for your teaching.
Yeah,
now, it sounds really kind of cultish and a little bit scary. Two things we've noticed. One is that the kids... within days, remind us if we've forgotten this.
Yeah, that's what they do. Yeah.
They find some use in this structure.
Yeah.
For me, the speaker early on was talking about ceremonializing. I don't know if it's making something different from whatever I'm doing, but whenever I bring my attention to what I'm doing in a formal way, it's really helpful. And yesterday I was thinking about Lena encountering the 49th day of her brother's passing, and I know he had a lot of meaning in her life. And so many spirits came to me yesterday in our service, and I could share my merit and the merit of the ceremony with them. And so, again, it was a way of bringing attention to 49 days or 82 days or whatever, or years. It was a wonderful way to share that attention and that remembrance. It just was a lovely gift. I also like the fact that the hungry ghosts bring out all my suffering, all the things I'm longing for, yearning for.
Yeah.
And that's a practice right there. Of acknowledging them, of talking about them.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And I so appreciated our social time eating and drinking after the ceremony.
Yeah. We shared the offerings, that is. Them. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, that's right.
We weren't getting feeding horizontal or anything.
Yeah. No, but feeding the hungry ghost. The whole song, I mean, the little sangha that we have, our bubble sangha.
Yeah.
So I don't know. I would love to know still more about the Buddha families and so forth, but those lines are incredibly moving to me.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Yeah, and they need to be appreciated too. Yeah.
It inspired me to do some studying, I can say that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, good.
It might be nice if we could share the service. I'm not sure everybody has. Is that service posted on our website?
No. No, we'll see if we can do something about it. Yeah.
Yeah, that might be nice because, anyway, thank you.
Thank you.
Those are my reflections.
Yeah.
Thanks, Anya.
Thanks, Anya. Yeah.
Pierre, you're up next.
Hello, Roshi. Good morning.
Morning. Morning.
It's just a question about our lineage. It seems that our lineage is a mixture of Rinzai and Sōdo.
Mm-hmm.
I've been to these schools, and I'm just wondering what you have in your criteria to mix the two and the difference between them.
Yeah.
And Shinto also.
Mm. Well, actually, it's a Sōtō lineage. And then the only Rinzai part of it is in the transmission documents, which have Dōgen's Rinzai lineage from the sixth ancestor down to him. And then from then on, it's just a straight Sōtō lineage. But the lineage that's on the Jukai Kechimiyaku or lineage chart is just Sōtō. But in terms of teaching lineage, we've received two other branches of the Rinzai school that Maizumi Roshi had.
With his teachers?
Kori Roshi, and who was the Inzan lineage, and Yasutani Roshi, whose teacher... Harada Sōgaku Roshi had received at least certification of realization from the Takaju lineage. Yeah.
But in terms of practice, they're just the same?
No, there's some differences. You know, there's some differences, but, you know, I wouldn't emphasize the differences that much. You know, people practice, they're sincere, that's good enough. It's like, you know, a lot of people say, well, Tenshin, you know, emphasizes koans and stuff like that. But my own basic practice right from the beginning has been just sitting meditation, shikantaza. I did koans for about 9 years. And I think koans are great for bringing out inquiry in people and going, being able to penetrate through difficulties and basing the life on the unknown rather than set patterns. But my practice is shikantaza, just sitting meditation.
So koan practice is also Sōtō or?
I wouldn't be Rinzai. So, you know, I mean, what we've inherited is a Rinzai basic Inzan school with some Takaju appreciation. I don't want to get into this too much, but yeah. Also the Sōtō koans of Master Hongzhi, I think it's Hongzhi Tendō Wanshi, yeah. That's 100 of them there in it. And also the precept practice, which has been modified from the Rinzai precept practice, is mainly a Sōtō approach in that. And also the Denkoroku too, which is a Sōtō Book of Koans by Master Keizan Zenji. Yeah.
Keizan.
Yeah.
Okay, thank you, Roshi.
Yeah, thank you.
Thanks, Pierre. Omar, you can unmute yourself.
Omar, you're on.
Did you say Omar?
Yes.
Yeah. Me?
Yeah. Okay. If you're Omar.
Great. Yeah, I am.
You're good.
I think.
Yeah.
So, Tenshin Roshi, how are you?
Good.
Hi, everyone in the group. So I wanted to share a couple of thoughts. Mm-hmm. The first thought that I had comes directly from my insecurity. So I wanted to say to the group, to everyone, as a composer and a producer and a musician, primarily as a songwriter, the last thing I ever want to do with any of my instruments is play a solo. So if I'm always talking in every single one of these, I just hope everybody understands that I'm just trying to make the most of this very little interaction that I have with absolutely anyone. So in this case, just making the most out of my access to a teacher.
Good.
So that said, the first thing I wanted to say is that I found incredibly moving and extremely relevant, or I don't know if I want to even say it's relevant. I just want to say I was really, really moved by the story that you told of Mizumi Roshi's response to the question if there were some kind of, some kind of mysterious zinger thrown in there or something, I could almost say it felt like a koan to me, you know?
Yeah, yeah.
It certainly just like triggered in me something that was like a very emotive response to this idea that for me is very real, because I come from a very difficult background. And I would say that for the, I actively say, and I actively recognize today that I have spent 27 years in a condition of suffering.
Yeah.
And that comes from, loss of somebody who I really loved when I was younger, a person who was practically my father, which started at 7.
Yeah.
Accompanying my grandmother through her mourning, which was 2 years of that, going through drug use and escapism for many years, starting at the age of 12, going through lots of, escapism from my personal home, going through very severe battles with everything from bipolarity and bipolar disorder to some very serious things, and just last year I was divorced. I don't have my wife anymore. I'm very alienated from my son right now, who's in Brazil. Although all of this has actually, I would say, since I really began what I consider my new path, it's really begun to resolve itself. And I'm really finding that now I've established my first steps into a path of non-suffering, which for me is what I call, I like to call it. I'm pursuing now a project of 27 years, just like the past 27 years of what I call a subtle joy. And I take that from Dostoevsky, who talks about a joy without which the world cannot stand. I don't want happiness. I don't want extremities. I just want a subtle, sustainable joy, which to me is just getting away from suffering, So I just wanted to say that I was really, really touched by that phrase, by what is the point of Buddhism? No, it's not all of those things. It's not enlightenment. It's not it's to end suffering. Just really hit me, I'll just end with my question is about my practice. So I do practice pretty much every day. I mean, sometimes I'll take a day off or so, but I do practice pretty much every day. I do have now these kind of rituals that are very ceremonious for me, which are not actually directly directly related to my practice. I burn a lot of frankincense resin. And I do that every morning, and I drink my tea, and I do this every morning, and I do it at night as well. And like somebody else mentioned, I'm also trying to incorporate a kind of a ceremoniousness or a value to my everyday banal practices. Mm-hmm. Everything from grooming to going to the store or whatever. I just try to be present, So that being said, when I practice at home, because I've never been to a ceremony or a practice at a Zen center, should I prepare for that practice by using the chanting? Should I try to share before we talk about this?
If it helps you to concentrate your mind, yeah, for sure. Yeah.
So, it would be good for me to just maybe learn them. And in what moment of practice does that come in?
Right now. Right now. I mean, start so,
sorry,
now.
Right
now.
No, that's not what I meant. No, that's not what I meant. If I'm meditating, usually I'll start by sitting. I'll spend, let's say, 25 minutes or so just sitting and just contemplating. And then usually I'll transition from there to maybe like I do my singing bowl to start to kind of snap me out of it.
Yeah.
Would before that moment of snapping out, would that be a good moment to do the chanting? Or should I do the chanting at the beginning?
Whatever works for you. Experiment and see what really works for you as a human being. But, there's one thing is that do value your momentary existence. So when you use word banal, don't do that. This is the only realization that you have this moment in time. And then as you begin to make that shift from a thought-based system to being present, an experience-based system, because you're not practicing these things that distance you from your momentary existence, this moment in time will become a lot more valuable to you as a human being. And that sense of, well, I'm doing this so I can get to that, will begin to disappear. And that's the thing, is because you're practicing this, you're not practicing that. And because you practice this more, that has less power. You do that over and over, then it really sinks in. And then, the other thing is that...
I really appreciate that.
Yeah, I mean, another thing you could say is that rather than trying to get into a zone or whatever, is that seeing through these eyes, try and escape from that.
I'm going to have to read about that or think about it more because I have a difficult time even understanding the concept. Seeing through these eyes, try to escape.
Without the story, see through these eyes, you're here, you're aware, you're awake. So being here, how can you escape this? And you begin to see is that there is no escape from this. It's only in our heads we think there's an escape.
I love that. Thank you. I appreciate that.
Okay.
May I ask one more question?
Yeah.
Which is a very small question. It's about the Diamond Sutra, and I can't get the final verses out of my head.
Yeah.
And the final verse, which I mentioned last week, it keeps kind of, going over and over in my head. And I know that I should wait. I'm reading it's 32 chapters for me to finally get to the word this, which is the word that's messing with my head.
That was the Buddha's intent. That's why the diamond cutter is like he's cutting away. Somebody brings something up, he cuts it down, and he keeps on doing that until you do reach the end. And that's where the sutra's working.
Well, I have every intention of getting to the end of the interpretation of the sutra, but it's just that I can't get it out of my head. So I just had one question about this. The final verse the verse that I can't get out of my head is the final four lines. It's not the final four lines, but it's four lines toward the end.
Yeah.
And the final of those four lines says, view all created things as this.
Yeah.
And I'm just wondering... the concept of this?
Better be. Not the concept of this, but this.
What I mean. It's this.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
Okay.
And then don't try and define this, experience this.
Right.
And that's what the Buddha was trying to do.
One-on-one.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
No, that's what the Buddha was trying to do, was get, whittle everything away down to this. Because most of us make it very complicated. And then we go off in many, even myself as I talk about it, that makes it complicated. Experiencing it is a lot more simple than that.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. Thanks, Omar. I appreciate it.
All right. Thank you, Omar. All right. So we're just out of time, but there's some items in chat. I thought I'd take a look at. So I'm just going to go to gallery view. Okay, Russell made a comment. I was at one point really hung up on ceremony and in opposition to it. I sat with for a good while and had sat with it for a good while and had some feelings of resentment from my lingering relationship with Catholicism. Can hardly say it. I found there was a dichotomy of sitting with no goal in mind or goallessness and the goal of valuing this particular moment that was important to ceremony.
Yeah. I mean, you know, I remember just with, in terms of Catholicism, I was raised as a Protestant, and so I had a lot of, conditioning around that. So I went to a funeral service, which was being done by a priest that I'd got friendly with. You know, we just had certain things in common. And I remember going there, and my old Protestant stuff was going on through in my head, going, "God, you're in the ceremony, Dad," you know, etc. And I just said to myself, "Come on, wait a minute, you know, do you want to sit here criticizing, or do you want to learn something?" You know, so this is you know my own thing going on, and then I want to learn something. So I started watching how the priest was doing the ceremony, and I was really moved by him doing it, because he was a bit overweight, and he was getting down on his knees many times, and praying, and he was so sincere. I learned something very deep from that. I really appreciated. It didn't matter what the form was, you know, on that level. But it's far better to learn something on you know, if I attend something like that. And again, with the present moment, it's not defined, it's not fixed, it's open. And so don't try and define that. That's the ceremony, is leave it be open. It's like, I remember when I was Jisha for my Zumiro, she would make mistakes. If I was fixed in that, then there would be no fluidity. But the part of the ceremony which was really good was the fact that then I had to make it be seamless, him seem seamless, by just going with that mistake and making it fit in, you know. And that was a better learning experience for me than anything else, you know. And the thing is, ceremony is going to be the way it is. There's always mistakes, there's always things in it. I remember once Shinko was officiating, and he went off to the altar, and he lost his underwear. They fell down. The elastic broke, you know. And part of that ceremony was for then the Jisha to pick you know to pick them up, and then everybody lost it. But that was part of the ceremony. You know, it's not the ceremony should be a certain way. It is the way it is, and how do you make it flow seamlessly? Everybody sort of regained their composure, but that was the ceremony. It is what it is. If you do that on a daily basis, ceremony isn't something special. It is what it is, and you make it fit. You make it work. That's the fluidity of it.
Thanks, Rishi.
De nada.
Looks like Jindo posted a link here. If anyone's looking at chat, for the five families on zenpeacemakers.org. And then I don't know their version of Gate of Sweet Nectar. He's saying ours is close, but ours is English, right?
Yeah, we've now converted it all to English, because we only do it once a year, so it's hard to get the fluidity of the Sanskrit / Japanese chanting. So we'll post that at some point.
Yeah.
In the near future.
Yes.
Yeah. Not tomorrow.
Nope.
Maybe. But soon.
And then let's see. Mm-hmm. It's a comment. In times of increased trouble, since there is always trouble, I have found that the days I maintain my ceremony, Zazen, koan, study, and journaling, I stay centered. When I skip it because I think I don't have time, I end up spending time fixing stupid mistakes like forgetting things or locking myself out of the house.
You too, eh?
And Lena's recommended a book. Yeah, I think everything else here is...
The Tibetans really have a good one, too. Yeah. Yeah, good. Trungpa Rinpoche does a really good job in either Myth of Freedom or the Cutting Through Spiritual Materialism. Mm-hmm. So you might have to buy both.
Yeah. Right. I think that's everything.
Okay. Good. We'll just open it up for chat.